Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of J-Talk Extra Time. I'm John Steele, and joining me, as usual, my regular partner in crime, Stuart Smith. Hi, Stuart. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Very good, John. It's very hot these days in Japan, but yeah, we've got some financial news to get to, so I'm wearing a suit and tie, so we should all be good to go, I think.
Okay, I won't ask you about the bottom half then. We'll just keep it. Yeah, I'm just looking. We're recording. We won't spoil it, Stuart. We're very late at night on Wednesday, June 3rd here. And in my living room, I have a digital chronograph or clock, and it displays the temperature. It's 27.6 degrees here in my living room as we speak. So yeah, don't ask me about my bottom half either. All right.
Okay. Mum's the word. It's all right.
Yeah. This week, Stu, on Twitter, you've extensively teased that we're going to be doing a deep dive into kind of some J2 financials this week. So we'll get onto that in a moment. Just before we do, I think we should echo the kind of celebratory mood on the big pod this week with the news that the J League is finally has a date to come back after the sort of coronavirus hiatus at the moment. Yeah, J2 and J3 are scheduled to restart on Saturday, June 27th. So about 3.5 weeks from when we're recording. Hopefully that all goes ahead, and we can get some football back. Of course, that'll be behind closed doors, for the foreseeable future. And I believe that the J League has another meeting this week. I think June the 9th. So next Tuesday, about some details such as allowing 5 substitutes, for example. Like they have done in some other leagues that have restarted already. So I don't think we're out of the woods yet on the coronavirus. It was interesting, to read today or last night, it broke that Mu Kanazaki, the Nagoya Grampus striker, tested positive for COVID-19. And also tonight, there was kind of breaking news in one of the baseball preseason games. The Yomiuri Giants were due to play a game this evening, I think, or this afternoon, but it's called off at the last minute because I think two of the Giants players have returned a positive test for the coronavirus as well. So I don't know if we can celebrate the return of the J League quite yet, Stuart. I think we better wait until the last minute to see if it goes ahead. But I think all the signs are positive so far. We should also mention briefly, and this is piggybacking from the big pod last week as well, the JFA announced kind of on the sly tonight that a new professional women's league is going to start, I think, in September 2021, the WE League, which I think is the Women's Empowerment League. And there aren't many other details as far as I know. But, it's good to hear that the women's game is going to be professionalized like the J League from September next year. Okay, I don't think there's any other business, Stu. So if you're ready to go, should we start the deep dive?
Yeah, just let me adjust my tie and put my waistcoat on. I think we're good to go.
When you say adjust them, you're just like ripping them off.
I'm just loosening it because it's so hot. Yeah.
Yeah, it is hot. Okay, so we discussed these are kind of financials a little bit in the green room before we started recording, Stu. And I think we need to come clean with the listeners. You've done not the majority of the work on this. You've done 100% of the hard graph, the heavy lifting, kind of translating the Japanese version of this and then tabulating it rather beautifully, if I may.
If it was a pie chart, it would be 100% of one color.
Yes. All the numbers look good, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of what you've done. So some of the clubs themselves maybe less so, which we'll get onto in a moment. But basically, we have tonight. We're going to focus. We're going to stick to J2 and cover J3 maybe next week or in a later pod, because I think there's enough data that it needs deserves its own bespoke pod, I think. So we have to kind of just go through the 16 of the 22 teams in J2 have reported their financials, I think, last week or the week before. I think I'm sort of a layman very much on this, and I haven't done the many hours of kind of prep over the weekend that you've done. So do you want to lead us off and give us an overview, or where do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. I think it's the first thing to say is that I'm not an economist and I'm not a financial advisor. What I've done, just to be completely frank and open, is I've translated the J-League financial document, and I've just tabulated and charted the results and look for any trends or any kind of surprising results that came up, and plenty of them did. You're right when you say that we've only got 16 of the J2 clubs' financial reports in. The ones that we are missing, quite annoyingly, include the two promoted teams, Kashiwa Reysol and Yokohama FC. It would have been good to see kind of the cost performance that resulted in promotion to J1 last year. Also, the other teams, Renofa Yamaguchi, Tokyo Verdy, Tochigi, and Mito. I would have liked to have seen Mito's accounts, because I think that they would have been quite good with regards to bang for buck, I would assume. Just to flesh that out a little bit more, five of the clubs, in fact, all of the clubs except Kashiwa, have signalled that Corona, the effects of the coronavirus have forced them to delay the results of their financial 2019, whereas Kashiwa operate on a different release schedule. I think they work on a financial yearly financial year schedule, so they were due to release theirs at the end of March, but they're obviously being checked and rechecked. So all the other clubs kind of had to submit their financials at the end of January this year. So obviously it takes a few months to get them checked, rechecked, see if there's any kind of abnormalities and whatnot. And but yeah, we've got 16 clubs worth of data to go from. I think probably the lead off is that, like, from a bird's eye view, the actual overall financial health of J2 is not that bad if you look at it from, like, in the big scheme of things. Overall revenues are up year on year. They're up 500 million yen from last year. Sponsorship revenue was also up 469 million yen. Gate receipts, they went up, but only very, very by a small amount, but a cumulative 31 million yen. The only kind of figures that went down were what are termed in the J-League as labour costs. So what you're talking about is players, staff, etc. Anybody that works for the club, they went down 136 million yen from last year. Obviously, they don't take into account the figures that haven't been released. So kind of you have to take those figures with a pinch of salt. But the overall financial health of J2 looks relatively all right. But it's when you start to dig down that things start to kind of appear a little bit more muddled. Just there were six clubs in J2 who posted a loss this year: Corfu, Gifu, Kyoto, Ehime, Fukuoka, and Ryukyu. Now, Ryukyu are a special case because this is the fourth year in a row that they've posted a loss. But like we spoke a little bit about last week, their net assets and everything that they own can be valued at more than the debt that they posted this year. So it's not counted as a debt. But yeah, six of the 16 clubs which released their financial statements made a loss. So the general health of the league looks all right, but when six of 16 post a loss, it starts to muddle it up a little bit, I think.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's this is why we need, it wouldn't be possible to kind of do a surface level kind of appraisal of the data. We have to go a little bit deeper to kind of see the bigger picture, if you like. What was the most kind of shocking or surprising you know, thing that popped out at you when you did the initial analysis? Was there something you were expecting to find but didn't, or something that made, you know, rub your eyes and check the strength of the beer you were drinking while you were doing it? Or
I think what I was looking for was cost performance. Now, whether not to get too technical, but how you define cost performance, it will vary from person to person, but there are two kind of distinct ways you can assess cost performance. One is comparing revenue to performance on the field, so the overall kind of financial health of the club off the pitch and how that affects performance on it. And there's also, if you kind of strip that down a little bit, you can assess the money that's spent on the team for the rewards that the team gets on the pitch. And yeah, I looked at those two things in a bit of detail, and kind of I told you earlier that Jeff United didn't do very well in either section of that particular kind of cost performance assessment. I think it'll come as no surprise for people to hear that Jeff have kind of underachieved, but just the scale of it, like one of the clubs with the biggest amount of revenue. I think they took a large amount of their revenue from like sponsorships. They got, I think, 70% of their money was from sponsorships, 11% through the gate. But when they actually went on the pitch, for the amount of money that they put into their team, so we're talking about staff costs, so players, coaches, managers, etc. When you compared the staff costs to points gained, they actually cost them nearly around 26 million yen per point.
That's a lot of yen.
It is a lot of yen. It's the largest amount in J2. For reference, the next closest team was Omiya Ardija, and they spent 20 million yen per point, but Omiya finished third in the league, and like Jeff didn't. Jeff finished well down the league. They finished with 43 points at a cost per point of 26 million yen, which is kind of, it was eye-opening for me to see that. I think at the other end of the scale, the teams that stood out for me were Ryukyu, who spent they spent the least amount of money on staffers than any team in the league. They spent, I think it's 252 million yen on their entire team operation. They gained 49 points, so divide those two and you get a point, yen per point of 5.1 million. So, like, for every point, Jeff were spending five times as much as Ryukyu. And Ryukyu gained six more points than Jeff.
What I'm hearing is that there's yet another type of league table that Jeff would be near the bottom of were it to exist.
They were doing well. The team with the best kind of cost performance ratio was I've already given you this data. I was going to say have a guess, it was Sveg and Kanazawa. They spent 311 million yen on their team this year. They finished, I think they finished 12th, I can't quite remember, but they got 61 points. That's good for 5,098,000 yen per point, which was the best mark in the league. I think the one that really stood out, though, was Montelio Yamagata. Obviously, they finished in the playoffs. They beat Omiya in the playoff semi-final before they lost to Tokushima Vortis in the J2 playoff final. They got 70 points at a cost of 7.8 million yen per point, which I think, kind of considering, for example, FC Gifu spent 15 million yen per point, I think Montedio Yamagata deserve kind of a lot of credit for the kind of cost effectiveness of their kind of approach to building a squad. And the results, obviously they didn't get promoted, but they came very close, and I think they showed the way, basically, because they showed what could be done on a fairly limited budget. I mean, they budgeted, their budget was less than, well, you name it, Kofu, Niigata, Kyoto, Fukuoka, Nagasaki, Jeff. I mean, they punched well above their weight financially, and so did Kanazawa, Ryukyu. Like, Kagoshima had the third best rate in the league, but they finished second bottom and were relegated. So, like, it's difficult to say that they did well. But, yeah, they spent 7.4 million per point, whereas Yamagata spent 7.8 million per point. And, I think that probably just shows what a good job Montedio Yamagata did this year.
Agreed. So something that I've often just felt kind of in my balls watching J2, Stu, is that there's like kind of two or three leagues within the league in terms of kind of club size or revenue, if you like. And I'm just looking now at the kind of labor cost kind of overall, and that to me, to my untrained eye, that seems to kind of bear that out a little bit, that there's kind of some, you know, the sort of median, or the average is about 700 million. But then you have like Omiya out in front with more than double that, and then Ryukyu and Kagoshima, Kanazawa, you know, Machida, Ehime, et al. At like 400 million, so way, way below that. Does that ring true to you? There's kind of the sort of two or three divisions, if you like, in J2, or is that too simplistic?
No, I don't think it's too simplistic, and I think if we had the data from Kashiwa and Yokohama, I'm pretty sure they would have been very similar to Omiya. They probably would have been more than Omiya, I think. But you're right. I think because we've been watching J2 for a while, we can see who is kind of performing well, who is kind of making the most of the resources that they've got, and who isn't. But these facts and figures, just they it's not confirmation bias per se, but they back up kind of a lot of what we've been what we've seen with our own eyes. So yeah, you're looking at when you look at the team costs, like if I had to kind of put a gun to someone's head and say, who do you think are the five teams that spend the least amount of money, then they probably would have given me Ehime, Machida, Kanazawa, Kagoshima and Ryukyu, quite possibly. They might have thrown in Gifu in there as well, I don't know. But yeah, it's plainly obvious to see. And it's not just from the labour costs either. It's from like the sponsorship revenue. So those four of the teams that I listed just there finished in the bottom four of the actual sponsorship revenues. So Ryukyu, Kanazawa, Ehime and Kagoshima. It's not difficult to see, you know. And yeah, gate receipts as well, like Ryukyu, Ehime, Kanazawa, Kagoshima, Machida, they all finished in the bottom five of gate receipts. So these kind of things, we see them with our own eyes, but the financial things behind them kind of they back up what we've been seeing as well. And I think it's true at the bottom. I think kind of at the top it's a little bit more kind of up for discussion, because like you've got, obviously, Omiya finished third in the league, but the next three teams for their staff costs were Jeff, Nagasaki and Kyoto. Now, all of them missed out on the playoffs. And so, like, I think without knowing Yokohama and Kashiwa's kind of overall spend or whatever, it's kind of difficult to make an assumption at the top. But I think, like, there is a, or there has been a separate league down at the bottom. And that's just kind of natural because it's the same kind of, with the exception of Machida a couple of years ago, it's the same suspects who are down there all the time. And yeah, I think the middle class of J2 is just big. I think there's just like, I mean, you can go through the, what do you call it? You can go through the data and you can see that, kind of Okayama, Kofu, like Tokushima as well, they have pretty kind of decent amount of like sponsorships and decent amounts of kind of money coming through. But I think yeah, the middle of J2 is kind of financially it's pretty close, and I think that represents itself in the final tables as well. I think like what these kind of results don't take into account is like star player status. So like, I wonder what it will be. I wonder what Kofu will be this year without Peter Utaka. And then on the flip side of that, how will Kyoto be without Peter Utaka, with Peter Utaka in their lineup? And so, yeah, these financial figures, like there is a kind of, there is a split towards the bottom. And that's why year on year, while Gifu were down the bottom, Ehime are never too far away. Obviously, we lost Kumamoto and Sanaki over the years. Tochigi are always down the bottom. Machida had that one season of kind of dalliance with the championship. But like, there's a theme that runs through. I think possibly Kanazawa are the only exception to it because they've kind of established themselves as a relatively safe mid to lower mid table J2 club, so I think they've done really well out of it.
I think that all tallies with kind of my kind of feeling. But like you said, it's really good to see actual sort of empirical data, even if we don't have the full set, obviously, of the 22 teams. It does kind of back up this idea that there's, yeah, like you said, there's a big middle class, if you like, in the 22 team league. Can we talk a bit about just like revenue for the clubs, you know, by category? So you've made these very snazzy pie charts for us that show kind of the percentage of revenue, like where the revenue came from. So something as a fan, and I've been a football fan for 25 years, I kind of guess I was sort of in the dark about this. I didn't really realize, I kind of thought gate receipts would account for a lot more revenue than they actually do in these stats. So the average give or take is about 10%, isn't it? About 10% of the club's revenue comes from gate receipts. I think the Kofu are an exception because it's about 20% for them. But was that something that you expected because of what you know from like kind of working behind the scenes at Gifu? Or were you kind of surprised like me that sponsorship is clearly the most dominant, the most important kind of revenue stream for clubs, and gate receipts actually not that important in comparison? Or am I was I naive or foolish to think that gate receipts would be account for a bigger portion of the total?
No, I was surprised as well. I knew sponsorship was a big thing, but I was basing that on Gifu because I know like I know how important sponsorship is at Gifu. Like 55% of Gifu's kind of money comes from sponsorship, so that's around 500 million yen, give or take a few million yen. But yeah, the average, yeah, like you said, the average for J2 is around, I think it's at 11%. Kofu is a complete outlier because I think they're the only one who hit 20%. Like, like when I look at, for example, Kyoto Sanga's revenue breakdown, they only get like 9% of their 9% of their revenue from gate receipts. And I know they have had a crappy stadium, but I still thought of Kyoto as being a club that could pull in kind of a decent amount of supporters. And especially when you think about last year when they started off so well, like you, I just thought that they would at least have double figures of for their percentage of revenue coming from gate receipts. And it's the same for it's the same for a lot of clubs. I'm just trying to find who am I looking for now, like Okayama. You always associate Okayama with having kind of relatively full stadiums, but like 12% of their revenue came from gate receipts. And so I think, yeah, that was a surprising thing for me.
It kind of made me wonder. In the past, I've always assumed that the league has been quite inflexible with kickoff times and things. You know, for example, J2 never gets much love from the kind of Friday night J League, that J1 gets in the DAZN era, for example. And I guess I just kind of put two and two together and came up with five and thought like, well, the match day revenue must be so important that they don't want to do anything that might interfere with that or reduce that. But then, you know, looking at the data broken down by category here, I kind of feel like, well, we may as well have some Friday night games or bizarre kickoff times, because it would only impact your bottom line in a very minor way, it seems. I don't know.
Well, I think going down that route, I think it's the benefits are there, but I think you take away the sporting benefits. For example, if you had a Friday night game between, say, Albirex Niigata and Fajian Okayama, you're not going to get any away fans going. Oh, you probably you might. I mean, those are two, especially Niigata, are a relatively big club. I mean, Niigata, as I should have mentioned as well, Niigata had 22% of their revenue from gate receipts, but that's not a surprise.
I forgot about
that. But that's not a surprise, though, is it? Right, because we associate Niigata with having a big, like a fervent support and big crowds at the Big Swan, and so that's not a surprise. I think if you take, I don't know, but then, yeah, how much of see, this is a thing that didn't come up in the figures, like away fans, how much do they impact the bottom line of the gate receipts as well. Like, I mean, yeah, you can probably justify it from a financial point of view, from a sporting point of view, and from a fan-centered point of view. I don't know how that would work, but, I mean, Friday Night Football, I mean, as long as it's backed, I don't have a problem with trying it, because, like, it might be, yeah, it might work in that, like, people can come after work on a Friday night, go have a few drinks or whatever. It's an interesting one, and but I think the general point is that kind of I was surprised as well at the amount of, or the low amount or the low percentage of revenue that came from gate receipts. Because, yeah, I just assumed that the gate receipts were ultra important. I mean, we'll come on to J3 in a separate podcast, but you look at the teams that are in Tohoku, Akita, Iwate, Hachinohe, Fukushima, like, they get 3 or 4% of their money from gate receipts, which is incredibly low. And, like, it's probably something that needs to be looked at up there just for the financial kind of viability of those clubs. But yeah, in J2, yeah, it's obviously not as severe as that, but like, I think Ryukyu only got 7% of their money from gate receipts. Omiya got 10%. I mean, you look at Nagasaki, 10%, just going through them now. Yeah, Kanazawa, 10%, Tokushima, 9%. I thought it would be more. I'll be honest. And then you stack that
against most teams where the sponsorship revenue is like 50 to 60% in most cases, isn't it?
Well, I think one of the things that you have to look at with the sponsorship as well is like, because you're looking at kind of Tokushima Vortis, and obviously they're backed by Pocari Sweat or Otsuka Pharmaceuticals, I suppose. So it's not a surprise that they've received kind of a large chunk of their money from sponsorship. Aumi are the same. They get 70% of their money from sponsorship. So you're looking at NTT Docomo putting a large amount of money in. Machida Zelvia, 65%. They're obviously backed by Cyber Agent now. They're getting through the money that they're given. I think, like, when you're looking at this kind of stuff as well, I think one of the things that jumped out to me is like Ryukyu. So Ryukyu only got 29% of their revenue from sponsorship, and this year they've forgone a shirt sponsor. So I don't know if you remember, but they're putting a picture of, is it Shirley Castle, the castle that burnt down,
revived.
Yeah. So I wonder kind of how much that might affect them this year. Again, the sponsorship tab on the kind of J League financial form doesn't specify shirt sponsorship, club sponsorship, like advertising hoarding sponsorship or that kind
it's
of
not,
stuff.
It's not that detailed.
No, it's not. Itemized. But it's you wonder, like, it's I was going to say it's a bravo move, but that's not the right expression. Noble, in the absence of a better word. It was a noble move for Ryukyu to put Shirley Castle, revive Shirley, on the front of their shirt. But I wonder how much money they've lost by doing that. And again, I mean, I'm not a financial analyst, and obviously the people in the front office at FC Ryukyu have obviously looked at the figures and said, oh yeah, we can do this. But yeah, I wonder.
I think that's an area where it gets very interesting, though, because there are cases where you might forgo a sort of medium level lucrative sponsorship in order to kind of gain sort of cachet. I don't want to say that that's what Ryukyu are doing here, because I think the motives for wanting to promote the reconstruction of Shuri Castle are very honourable and noble, like you said. But I think there are examples from other leagues we can pull in. Like, I think there's multiple teams in the UK, for example, are going to have like NHS, you know, National Health Service sort of messaging as their, you know, an inverted commas shirt sponsor next season. And, you know, Barcelona have obviously probably led the way by having, you know, UNICEF as their shirt sponsor, but they paid UNICEF to have the logo. But really, I think if you want to be cynical, that was just to pave the way for them to have the lucrative kind of Qatar Airways sponsorship later.
And then,
used to the idea of having a sponsor on the iconic shirt, wasn't it, in the first place?
Yeah, I think so. And I think they can afford to do it. Like,
Oh, yes, sure.
The teams in Spain's La Liga or the Premier League or even the Championship in England, Bundesliga, etc., I think they can forego a season or two of non-shirt sponsorship, because the money that they receive from TV deals, especially international TV deals, is so astronomical that they can cover things. FC Ryukyu, I don't know. Like, they brought in 632 million yen last year, which was comfortably like the lowest in the league. So when you take out a shirt sponsorship, or when you kind of remove shirt sponsorship from the table itself, I wonder how that would affect them. But at the same time, like, it is noble, and I agree with you in that it's no way kind of opportunistic. And Shuri Castle is a landmark of Okinawa, and like any kind of promotion that they can do for it will do an untold amount of good. So it's great for them to do it. From a front office point of view, I wonder how much money they're missing out on.
I think that kind of circles us back round to the point you made eloquently at the start, that success, if you like, or cost performance cannot necessarily be measured just with the data or just with the spreadsheets. When you're thinking about something like a lot of the J League, you know, it's part of the J League kind of club license or part of the J League's ethos that clubs, you know, were embedded in the local community, if you like. So perhaps the J League, even if Ryukyu returned worse financials overall, the J League might look the other way on that point, if they can be seen to demonstrate, you know, good behaviour, if you like, in other areas. And I think that's something that, yeah, I think J League teams do try to do, is be active in the local community. And if your local area needs that, needs the front of the shirts for something more important, then I think it's, yeah, like you said, it's admirable that teams are able to accommodate that. But I think that there probably is, I don't think that decision would have been arrived at lightly, as you say. And I'm sure there was a conversation along the lines of, hey, if we do this now, then local companies will want to sponsor us and sponsor our shirt in the future.
Well, I think
because they'll know that we're good for it, if you like.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that kind of what underpins all this is that looking at the financial data, like Ryukyu have performed far in advance of what they probably should have done. So when you look at kind of the money that they've brought in, not just from sponsorship, but just in general, kind of altogether, like they were, they comfortably brought in the lowest sponsorship. They were comfortably at the bottom of the gate receipts table. They're also bottom of the overall revenue table. But the fact that they kind of finished, I can't even remember, did they finish 15th possibly. I can't remember off the top of my head.
I can't remember.
But the fact that they finished comfortably clear of relegation and lost their kind of best player halfway through the year when Koji Suzuki moved to Seretse Osaka, they did a fantastic job. And like, I kind of knew it when you looked at them last year. Like, they weren't the most kind of thrilling team to watch, but the fact that they did all that on a budget that was so restrained, and when you can put Ryukyu and hold them up against a team like Jeff, a well-established J League team like Jeff, who can bring in kind of five times the amount of advertising or sponsorship revenue that they can, and they can pay five times the wages that Jeff United can, it makes you kind of appreciate the work that smaller teams have to put in, because they have to work within their means. I know Ryukyu lost money, and they have lost money in the last 4 years, but they've actually put things in place where that loss of money doesn't detract from the actual club itself, because they've obviously kind of persuaded the J League that the assets that they have outweigh the debt that they've taken on in the past year. And I think that the quote-unquote smaller clubs like Ryukyu, like Kanazawa, you know, they have to go through a lot, and the decisions that are made in those boardrooms are not easy decisions to make. Like, you think about kind of decisions that these teams make about kind of signing players or kind of releasing players or kind of signing players to new contracts or whatever. And because money is so, not, it's not tight and it's not scarce, but it's something to be valued. It's like, yeah, it's the difference between like knowing the cost of something and knowing the value of something. I think that the smaller teams in J2, when you're given the facts and figures that the J League released this year, like you look at Kanazawa, you look at Ryukyu, and you look at teams like Yamagata, who do extraordinary things with kind of a budget that really they shouldn't be able to do those good things with. And so it gives you kind of an added I'm struggling for words tonight. I'm all numbers. I want to say it's admirable, but you said it was admirable. Like, admiration, there you go. It gives you, especially like coming from a Giphy supporter, like we finished bottom, but our net spend was kind of nearly three times what Kanazawa and UQ did per point. And yeah, it's, I'm a bit envious, but at the same time, like the Kanazawa and Ryukyu, Yamagata, Kofu to a certain extent, they do really good things on a really strict budget, and that is to be applauded in today's game.
I think that's a very good point. And you know, it's something that I think fans of bigger clubs, certainly back home in our homeland in the UK, you know, you often have that phrase, they celebrated like they'd won a cup final, you know, for example. But I think the thing is very important, because yes, if you're one of the smaller teams like Ehime, you don't get to knock off these big teams where the players are all getting paid more money than you. You know, everything at their ground is better than everything at your ground. So of course, it means a lot to you when you produce those results and get those wins. And you know, I'm a fan of a small team, so I've experienced that as well, and it's fantastic. So yeah, I think, you know, when it comes to equality, they're all in the same division, aren't they? But some are clearly more equal than others when it comes to the finances, and that you know, the data that we've gone through tonight really kind of highlights that, brings that home, I think. So you kind of can't begrudge the Mitos and you can't begrudge like the Mitos or the Ehimes from celebrating big when they get a good win. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, like, because I did put the call out for questions, and I think we've probably covered most questions, and I've kind of tried to answer them during this pod, kind of subliminally. But there are a couple of questions that that came up that were really specific, and like Big Pod Sam said, like, he asked about Kyoto and their stadium, and like if any enforced kind of supporter absence would hurt them with regards to repayments. I need to do a little bit more research, which I'm sure will be music to the ears of my wife, who she always asks, what are you doing? I'm just looking at facts and figures. It's all right. But like,
I'm sure she's perfected the eye roll by now.
Yeah, I've just turned away. I just turn away when I say this kind of stuff to her. But I've been doing a little bit of research. Like, it's a very convoluted, believe it or not, it's a very convoluted kind of payment system that Kyoto have, because there's a combination of things. There's a combination of the local authority, the prefectural authority, and there's grants from like a sports lottery company, and also there's an increased tax burden on the local taxpayers as well. And so I don't know how much Kyoto are liable for, but also they were, and something I didn't know, they were forced to change their stadium plans to incorporate kind of a more multi-use aspect to it. So within the stadium, I think there's an open use swimming pool and an open use climbing wall, and that ticked a couple of boxes.
They have bouldering.
Sorry, I talked over you.
What was the last one?
No, there's a swimming pool and a climbing wall. Just two of the things that had to be added in order to qualify for, I think, some kind of multi-purpose grant, something like that. And so they've done some things with that. There's another couple of questions as well. 90th minute sub on Twitter asked me about the squad kind of numbers. Like, he said, is there any factual evidence that limiting the number of players under contract, for example a maximum of 35 for all J League teams, would lead to financially healthier clubs in Japan? There's no factual evidence for that, but just the eye test, I'm not sure that would work, because I think it needs a comprehensive reform of contracting as well, because most players are on 1-year contracts, so players don't actually move for fees that often.
I think he added a kind of I'm assuming it's a he. I don't want to misgender anybody. The 90th minute sub did add a kind of a clarifier about, you know, would it be better to have that limit so that there'd be more free agents basically for J2 and J3 teams to sign. And then they could sell them. Yeah, but I think not to interrupt your answer, I'll come back to you in a second. But I think the issue's been in the past that even when players are sold, it's even if it's not for nothing, it's almost nothing, which would mean that any gains would probably be pretty negligible, I think. But yeah, sorry, Stu, I talked over you again. I'm doing a lot of that.
No, that's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to say that, like, it might be easier for them to take on as free agents, young players, whatever. But unless you're a club that's signing players to 2 or 3 year contracts, then you're not going to get any benefits from kind of selling them, because they'll just walk away at the end of a contract, or you'll get a minimal amount of money in June or July for them if they set the world alight. And so, I don't think there's any benefit to, I mean, there probably is a benefit to having a maximum squad limit, but I don't think there's a financial benefit to smaller teams, because in general it's a contract thing, right? And so it's, if you're only signing contracts from January 31st to January 31st, say, which is, I think it's the typical length of a Japanese contract, then it doesn't really matter, because if they do well for you, you'll lose them anyway. And if they don't do well for you, then you'll have to think about whether you want you want to keep them on, or that kind of stuff. And so,
I think another thing that happens increasingly, and I think is only going to get worse / more common, depending on your point of view, is that players who are really good and have real potential, they get snapped up when they're so young, when they're like 16 or 17. So, you know, at the top end, it's players like Takefusa Kubo, for example. But even like, he's come up on the pod before, but the goalkeeper from Yokohama City, Shibuya, who left when he was like 17 or 18 to go. And the clubs, even if they had like a tribunal system here to decide fees, they're selling clubs in a very weak position because the player's like 17 years old and hasn't played many games, you know. So it's all based on potential, which is very difficult to quantify with it with a number. I think where I agree with 90th minute sub is definitely the squad size is definitely an issue. But I think it's a system problem that, like you said, I think would need more of an overhaul of like the contract system and fees in general. Like, for example, you hear a lot in Spain, or it's not really comparable, but like that having buyout clauses and things where players can even buy out their own contract if they want to. Clubs might even make more money having a buyout clauses where players can buy out their own contract than selling them to other clubs who are not exactly flush with cash anyway.
Yeah, I think I think that's quite right, and I think that it's more of it's less a club finance problem than a player / agent kind of driven kind of thing, really. I'm all for squad limits, but I think we're possibly coming at it from a different angle from 90th minute sub, but I think the end result is the same. I think the end result would be if you had a squad limit, I think that would be a good thing. But whether it would help clubs sign players and develop players and get rewarded for that development, I in this current situation, no, I don't think it would. But that's not to say without some kind of rule change, or some kind of a bold club that signs young players on 5-year contracts. But I think something that we should probably wrap it up soon, but like something that will come up in the J3 kind of financial part, is that clubs don't know how they're going to be in two, three years, never mind 4 or 5 years. So for those clubs in the lower half of J2 who are threatened with relegation, and in the J3 when they can never be sure of promotion, it's almost financial suicide for them to kind of commit to paying a player of potential for 3 years on the off chance that they will rip it up in J3 or J2 and another club like a J1 club will come in and sign them. I think it's very, very difficult for them to do that. and especially kind of lower half of J2. I mean, yeah, in the J3 pod, we'll talk about Kumamoto and Sanaki, who were relegated last year. They suffered horrendous drops in gate receipts, sponsorship revenue. And it's because J3 is a much less lucrative league than J2. And so if you sign players on 2 or 3 year contracts, like clubs don't know where their finances are going to be at the end of any given year, let alone 2 or 3 years down the line. And so I'm not kind of confident that that will change anytime soon. It might be different for clubs like Vissel Kobe, who can sign Iniesta for 3 years, or they can put Kyogo Furuhashi on a 4 year contract, or those kind of things. But for J2 clubs and J3 clubs, I genuinely don't think that's an option, because the financial situation is so volatile that it would be kind of difficult for them to commit a certain amount of funds to a player who may or may not make it. It's a gamble that has upside, but it also has downside as well. I mean, you know, you're looking at if you want to pay a good university graduate to come, say, to Gifu or Kumamoto or Ehime, like, you need to persuade them, and you probably need to persuade them with, A, you're going to get a chance to play, B, we're going to pay you some decent money. But if that player doesn't work out, like, it's difficult to move him on. If he's got 2 years left on his contract at a decent amount of salary, why would he move on? And that's the kind of thing that I think is more of a structural problem between players, agents and clubs, as opposed to like a purely kind of like financial / squad limit kind of problem to have, I think.
For some reason, Michael Reitziger at Chelsea popped into my head there when you were talking about players not wanting to move.
Well, I was thinking about Jack Rodwell from Sunderland today.
Yes, the plot thickens. Yeah. Okay. I think Alex Bishop was asking as well, Stu, about a breakdown of the revenue streams of J2 and J3 clubs. I think we've given kind of pretty broad brushstrokes kind of breakdowns today. That data is available, so we have a version of that. We're still not sure how we are going to disseminate that. Is that right? We might make that available for people, but we're not sure yet.
Yeah, we're not sure yet. I need to tidy it up for publication, but at some point I will make it available when I'm happy that I've double and triple checked everything and made sure that there's no kind of spelling mistakes or kanji misinterpretations and things like that. But yeah, there will be, like, because I've spent a lot of time doing it, and I still haven't finished yet, because I still have to finish the J3 expenditure charts and those kind of things as well. But
that sounds like something for the weekend.
Yeah. I mean, some people go out to nightclubs, some people stay in and tabulate J3 finances. It's just the way of the world these days.
I think Alex had a bit of a follow-up as well. Are the lower league clubs subject to higher levels of risk? And I think
not to be glib,
but basically yes, isn't it?
I think there is certain, like, we spoke a little bit earlier about like gate receipts not being a major part of clubs' financial makeup, which is fine. If you play in stadiums without supporters for 2, 3, 4 games or whatever, I think that's okay. I think where it gets a bit dodgy is that I think the reason that most clubs are happy about playing a full slate of games is that they need season-long revenue from sponsorship. I think one of the things that stuck out from the J2 finances was, and just let me get this up so I'm not making any mistakes here, Avispa Fukuoka last year suffered a 297 million yen loss on the previous year from sponsorship. Now, a lot of that, I did some research into it, and a lot of that is because they were away from their level 5 stadium due to the Rugby World Cup for a large stretch of their season. And that means they couldn't sign year-long sponsorship deals with companies, and because the sight lines at Hakata no Mori Stadium, it's an athletic stadium, so the sight, so like the level 5 stadium in Fukuoka, I think it's got a different name now, I can't quite remember what it is, but it's a football specific stadium, so like the sight lines from the fans to the sponsor boards and from the pitch to the sponsor boards are actually a lot clearer than they are at Hakata no Mori, which is an athletic stadium, and it's like a big kind of, it looks like an Eastern European relic from like the 70s or something, and they couldn't sign year-long sponsorship deals there, and so they lost a lot of money. They also lost a lot of money just because they couldn't kind of they were away from their home stadium, so they had the extra cost of setting up at Hakata no Mori and things like that. But the sponsorship, to suffer a year-on-year loss of nearly 300 million yen, which is nearly a third of their sponsorship revenue between 2018 and 2019. I think maybe some of it was to do with that when they did actually get back to the level 5, they were pretty shit as well. I don't think that's to be underestimated. Sorry, Navy Blue Wasp, I do apologize.
Like 50 minutes in without swears.
Yeah, I know. I should put an explicit
big finance pod.
But like, I think that probably had something to do with it as well. But that's why I expect that they will increase their sponsorship revenue this year, assuming that all the J2 games get played. But I think that in general, Alex's point is right in that J2 and J3 clubs are exposed to a lot more risk because their financial boundaries are a lot tighter. They don't have, well, with exceptions like Nagasaki or even Iwate now, who are backed by Nova Corporation, they don't have these big corporations backing them. They're very reliant on a multitude of sponsors, and when you're in a situation like we're in the COVID-19 situation, like a lot of companies are feeling the pinch. I know Nissan turned in their first loss in 11 years. I wonder how that'll affect Yokohama F. Marinos, for example. But you take that and you extrapolate it down the leagues, then it's not hard to see that how much of a pinch it would put teams in. Like Fujieda in J3, 78% of their income comes from sponsorship. It doesn't take a lot of companies in that particular area to start feeling the pinch, which that would put them on the precipice. And so I think like they are, J2 and J3 clubs are more susceptible to the kind of variances of kind of the corporations and their own financial health as it relates to the sponsorship of their clubs.
Very, very, very well put, Stuart. And yeah, I just want to say thank you to everyone for sending in questions, because yeah, I was overwhelmed by the quality and quantity of what Stuart produced this week. So I needed some help to kind of take the conversation where I wanted it to go and where the listeners wanted it to go. So thanks for sending in the questions on Twitter. Okay, Stu. Well, I think we're out of time for this week's show, and we had a good in-depth look at some J2 financials. I think this topic will come back when we get some financial results from the other six teams that haven't reported yet in J2. And as you mentioned, we do have a J3 themed financial deep dive coming up as well, possibly next week or at least in the very near future. I think before we sign off, we should, as usual, say thanks to the patrons who helped to make J-Talk Extra Time possible, but indeed all the listeners, anyone who takes the time to download our show and give us a listen, we really appreciate it. Stu, where can people catch up with you if they take issue with your analysis?
If they take issue with my analysis, they can always hit me up at @sushi_football. And I would actually, it's an interesting topic, this one. If anybody has any questions or anything that they kind of want me to go over in a bit more detail, or like go over the facts and figures, I'd be more than happy to do so. So yeah, I'd @sushi_football if you so wish to. How about you, John?
Okay. You can follow me on Twitter at J2CantoBytes. I'm not tweeting much just right now because of work and real life, but I do tweet whenever I can. And hopefully with the football coming back at the end of the month, there'll be more tweeting from me and from Stuart. But Stu, thanks again for all the hard work you put in this week. You've done a sterling job and put me to shame. I shall try and put that right when we reconvene. I should get my own spreadsheets, with blackjack.
I've thrown the gauntlet down. That's what I've done.
You've certainly raised in as much as Jeff have raised the bar for financial mismanagement. You've raised the bar for pod prep, I think, this week. I hope everybody enjoyed the show and stay safe, stay well, and we'll be back again next week for another round. Okay, but that was the J Talk Extra Time, and thanks, bye for now.